next speaker, my boss, and also the director of the Occupational and Environmental Health section for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. And he is also an assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, Rajiv Bhatia. He has been responsible for environmental health law and policy in San Francisco since 1998 and has broadened the scope of the local environmental health to include labor rights, working conditions, housing, land use, transportation, injury prevention, and food security. He has pioneered the practice of health impact assessment in the U.S., institutionalizing health impact assessment in San Francisco government, teaching the first U.S. graduate course on health impact assessment at the University of California at Berkeley, and has co-founded Human Impact Partners, a nonprofit organization working locally to build a field. He is a founding member of the Health and Social Justice Team at the National Association of County and City Health Officials and has co-edited Tackling Health Inequities Through Public Health Practice, Theory to Action. Dr. Bhatia has earned an MD from Stanford University in
1989. One of the things I'd like to say about June's work, and I think it'll apply to our work, is that we didn't start out with a policy goal, or we started out with a local problem. And I think that the work, the research, the discovery, the solution, and its scalability or adaptability really comes from that starting from a local grounded problem. And I think that all of our work in our unit has really started that way. The next presentation, and I'm going to be talking about strategies to improve indoor air quality that are responsive to the differences in outdoor air quality. Again, this is something that I never anticipated working on. I didn't say, okay, I'm going to work on the problem of outdoor air quality migrating indoors. This really came from a local issue, and so. It's just a very salient characteristic of all of our work in our unit, and I wanted to emphasize it. So the context for this work was not, again, indoor air quality or building design. The context was the problem and the challenges of infill land use development. Now, half a century ago, we said, let's move out to the countryside. Why are we moving out to the countryside? The air is nice there. There's lots of grass for people to run around. It's healthy out there. We moved out to the countryside for our health. And 50 years later, we realize that, we didn't see this coming. We didn't see all the problems that greenfield development would form. And let's actually move back to the city. Let's do infill development, right, in these areas. But what did we do? We created these channels, these traffic sewers between the suburbs and the cities. And when we now think about infill development, and I think that the infill development promoters will say, this is going to improve air quality for the region. This is going to reduce driving. It's efficient use of resources. And that's all true. It's a wonderful idea. But it's not like it's not going to have any externalities. And if we don't think of those externalities and manage those externalities, we're going to be faced with the same kind of problem that we're getting when we did greenfield development. And we should, I think, remember that. So that was the point we found ourselves. We found ourselves supporting infill development in San Francisco, but also being critical of it, saying that the conditions in urban areas are with high traffic are going to create risks to air pollution, to risks from noise, risks from traffic safety. How do we manage those risks? One of those risks, and just one of them, is the issue that the areas that we left when we went to the are areas of air pollution hotspots. Now, the problem, a very fundamental problem around managing this issue, is that we don't really know what the air quality is like in these urban areas. Well, why don't we know? Well, we have the Clean Air Act, and the Clean Air Act says, let's monitor air pollution, right? And it directs states to put up air quality monitors. But where are those monitors? Those monitors are not near air pollution sources, deliberately not near air pollution sources. So you don't put the air pollution monitor near the highway. You don't know what the air pollution is near the highway. But we've now decided to put people near the highway, right? Without knowing that. And it actually doesn't take an air quality monitoring scientist, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, to know that the air quality is probably going to be worse near the freeway, right? Anyone disagree? Anyone think it's going to be better near the freeway? No one's going to raise their hand. Well, there's actually a way to know, right? I mean, it's like there's been a way to know for a while, and the way to know from the 70s, you can put a monitor in your freeway, right? Pretty simple. But you can do other things too. You can use very sophisticated, now very powerful computers and sophisticated models of how pollution moves when you know the weather and you know the wind speed, and actually predict, if you know where the pollution is coming from, you can predict where the pollution is and where those hot spots are, not precisely, but relatively accurate from a relative perspective. And that was the first thing we did to deal with this problem. Again, now buildings have not even come into the picture yet. Improving indoor air quality has not even come into the picture. But now we know where the outdoor air pollution hotspots are by using existing technology to create a map. And in one of these green areas, the monitor for San Francisco is in one of these green areas, right? Everything's fine. But you can see there's red areas where we believe air pollution is much higher than what would be optimal for public health, and I won't get more detailed than that. So this map itself has been very powerful because it really moves planners, it moves builders, it moves the development community, it moves the community to say we need to do something about the areas in red. And so there are two different things you can do. I mean, and the harder thing is to make that area in red smaller, right? Because what's happening? Actually, we are now stopping people from living in the suburbs. We're moving people into the infill areas. Those cars are still coming from the suburbs, and now we're going to have more cars from the people who are generating trips going out from the living in these infill areas. These red spots are not going to go down, even with emission standards on cars going down. And their noise is not going to go down at all because we're not really doing anything for noise control. And the traffic safety issues are not going to go down at all because we're not doing much about that. So that's really hard. And maybe over the long term we can make roads smaller and with less lanes and we can tear down the freeways, but that we have to wait for earthquakes, for that kind of stuff to happen usually. And that takes some time. But there are exposure management things to do. There's harm reduction things to do. And one of the, again, a very obvious solution is, well, if you've got outdoor air pollution and you got a building, can you improve the ventilation system to protect the indoor air? And of course you can. We do this with hospitals. We do this with astronauts. We do this for a lot of people, and we can do it here too. And a harder problem is, can you improve the ventilation in existing residential dwellings? And so that's actually the most important part of the presentation, that these are two things that we need to do for these reasons, and there's probably lots of ways to do that. How did we do that in San Francisco? So this map scared the planners. It scared the developers. They said, "Oh shit! The health department's going to say these areas are poisoned, or even if the health department says it's okay, people are going to freak out because that's what people do." And they didn't, So the fact that we had this map, it was just really creating a lot of nervousness. And so we leverage that nervousness to say, "Okay, planners, not only have we now presented you the problem, we're going to present you with a solution." And the solution was, okay, we've got these scientists at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. They've studied ventilation. They say that you can put in this kind of ventilation, remove 80% of the particulates. How about we pass that as a law? Okay, let's pass that as a law. It was the quickest law that we got passed, the first in the country law to require ventilation standards for residential buildings in high pollution areas. This was not a brilliant thing. Maybe it was brilliant strategically. It wasn't brilliant from sort of a technological standpoint. If you look at the ventilation profession's manual, ASHRAE's manual for ventilation guidance, it says do this. Look at the outdoor air pollution and modify the ventilation systems and filtration systems to account for the outdoor air pollution. So it's always kind of been there, sort of in principle. So that's been a very successful law for 4 years in San Francisco. Unfortunately, it hasn't spread, and I think it will spread because it's kind of obvious. It's what we do for noise. When there's outdoor noise is bad, we have higher insulation. When soil is contaminated, we remove it. When there's vapors coming up, we siphon them off. When we have earthquake instability hazards, we make the building stronger. When now we have outdoor air pollution problems, we make the ventilation system better. It's actually a really simple thing to do. But there's benefits and limits to this, right? So protecting the indoor air isn't the only thing that, you still have the freeway, you still have the traffic hazards, you still have other problems to deal with. So there's probably more to do in this regard. The problem of so this deals with the new residents, the new wealthy people in their high-rise condos, and, so great, we've made their lives better now. And what about the 99%? Or the 47%, whichever, what are we going to do for the 47%? We have been thinking about how to power the retrofit case. It's not a problem. The solutions have not been studied in the retrofit case for improving ventilation. So that work needs to be done. We are trying to learn about that in San Francisco by doing some experiments of existing buildings. One way to move that forward, one way to power it, might be to link the ventilation improvements to energy efficiency programs. And how many of you know about energy efficiency, more or less? Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot of interest in energy efficiency. It's going to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and all of that, right? And climate change prevention. But if we're going in there and we're making these improvements, we can be also doing things to improve indoor air quality in the same go. And I think there's actually a rationale, because when you tighten the building, you're actually reducing the removal of indoor air pollution, air pollutants that are generated. So there's actually a health and safety need to do that in the first place. We are finishing up a health impact assessment of this, and we looked at how would doing two different things, targeting energy efficiency programs to high pollution areas and augmenting those energy efficiency programs with additional noise protections and indoor air quality protections, what would the value be of that to public health? And with the University of California at Berkeley, with the help of students and staff, we're in the middle of doing this health impact assessment. How am I doing with time? Okay. So I don't want to get into the findings or the methods of this, but I think the long and the short of it is that even in San Francisco, which is a relatively clean air pollution environment, there's fairly substantial benefits in the two areas that we looked at, which is premature mortality from particulate matter and reductions in the impacts from noise. From both targeting and additional mitigations, the going from the standard weatherization pattern to a weatherization plus indoor air elements doubled the benefit in terms of premature mortality, targeting and the risk in targeted areas was about three times as much as the non-targeted areas. So this kind of leveraging has a significant cross benefit. And I don't want to really get. We're going to have a report on this, but I think it's an area that needs quite a bit more study and practical experience. But it does seem like sort of a good step forward, and I encourage you to sort of read this report, criticize this report, And think about what kind of research does this report demand? Because we're really at the beginning of thinking about merging these two, these ideas. Again, we also looked at two things. We looked at the reduction of particulate matter from the outside and the reduction of noise from the outside. There were other things we could have looked at. We could have looked at, well, how does this affect the indoor air pollution generation? How does this affect allergens? We didn't look at the impacts of this on the main driver, which is energy performance, because this actually could make energy performance a little bit more challenging if ventilation systems are having to cycle more and require more energy. So it's a complex thing, but it's a potentially a huge win-win. Why is this? And again, I'm skipping the details. Why is this important? Because if you have support, if you have a rationale for energy efficiency alone, that's going to get us some resources for energy efficiency programs. If you have a health rationale, you're going to have another interest group. You're going to have more people, more interest in this solution. So it potentially could really power both the energy efficiency and indoor air quality movements by linking up these two forces. So lastly, let's get to the source, right? So these things are great, but it's expensive to constantly have to protect the inside, do the astronaut thing, right? Protect the inside from bad pollution outside. It probably is more efficient in the long run to be dealing with, the outside. And there's lots of problems here. We don't cost all of these externalities. One of the things that health impact assessment is trying to do is trying to show that all of the health impacts associated with these environmental conditions that and all of these uncounted externalities that really should be counted when we make planning and land use decisions. And hopefully to become a force to sort of making healthier decisions, ones that don't rely on sort of mitigating the inside from, one pollutant, or another. So some of those regional air pollution strategies, first and foremost, at a national level, we need to revise the Clean Air Act. We need to revise the Clean Air Act, not to change, we keep talking about changing the standards. We need to revise the Clean Air Act to actually measure in places that are important, where people are. Revise the Clean Air Act to measure pollution where people are to see if standards are being violated or not. Now, that shouldn't require an act of Congress, and thank God it doesn't. It doesn't require an act of Congress. EPA can do that. They can change their monitoring program without an act of Congress. We need to regulate traffic corridors as emission sources. So we regulate factories and power plants. Gosh, we even regulate dry cleaners. If we regulate dry cleaners, shouldn't we regulate the highway? Is the highway not an air pollution source? It's got lots of little cigarette butts, right, burning, as it kind of goes along, right? It's little smokestacks, all horizontal. They may be very efficient smokestacks, but they're smokestacks nevertheless. Nothing is done to regulate the highway, and we keep building the highways and extending them. There are really innovative solutions that are being used elsewhere, like speed control. In Europe, Europe is a state. Right? I don't know what Europe is, but Europe is a blue state. They're controlling the speed on freeways as a way to reduce the pollution near the freeways. Because at about 45 to 55, you have sort of optimal energy, engine efficiency. And that can reduce PM levels and nitrogen dioxide levels by 25%. And they do this through speed controls on the freeway. Anyway, this is a big work in progress because it's not just roadways and industry. There's construction work. There's your local charcoal broiler. All are urban pollution sources, and we need to think about all of this. So that's it. Thank you. It's my two question time. Two questions. I'm going to go here. Well, no. And I would say no. I mean, somebody can, but we don't have an ultrafine standard. We have a PM standard, right? So the power of doing this, I mean, have we done this ever? Have we maximized this? We have a law in San Francisco for PM. Let's get that law passed elsewhere. Let's get that problem. Let's get PM 2.5 addressed before we move on to ultrafines. You know, researchers keep finding something new to study, but we don't solve the problem that the researchers found last, you know, the decade ago. We're just now finishing the problem of diesel. We're starting to deal with it seriously. So I would say I wouldn't spend any energy on it. Second, I think the second reason is that ultrafines are going to correlate with PM as far as traffic sources go. Traffic, and so I think the strategies on the PM are going to work. The part I would go forward with is thinking about, can filters be improved in our existing, or how are filters dealing with the ultrafines, and can filters be improved? I think that's a point to work. But let's get that one problem solved before thinking about the next pollutant. I'm going to let you pick. Okay. Briefly. So, it's hard and it's tentative, and it's we're going to probably have lots of people criticizing it. So, we calculated the attributable burden of mortality from outdoor PM pollution using our model of PM outdoor PM and where we knew the population was and the different mortality rates in the population, using the standard, you know, EPA risk assessment. Then, and Solange is in the room. You can talk to Solange afterward. She is a student that worked on this project. We calculated how a change in what weatherization or weatherization plus filtration would do to the intrusion of outdoor air PM indoors, and how the PM, indoor PM levels would change. Now, that's problematic because epidemiology isn't based on indoor PM. It's based on outdoor PM. So we said, how much would the indoor PM change in the house? And then we created a metric, which was your total 24-hour weighted PM exposure, making some assumptions about where people were across the day and how much time they were indoors. We took the change in total 24-hour PM, time-weighted PM exposure, and said, if that fell by 10%, then your total PM 2.5 attributable mortality from outdoor air pollution is going to drop by 10%. It's not perfect, but... That would be great for a researcher to come and research. Nope. It's a good natural experiment. Thank you.